Stephen, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, folks. Thanks for having me on and showing up this time on Wednesday, the 21st, before the holidays. I think this is my last professional act before I head out with my family, so I appreciate you being here very much. So I'm a professor at Purdue. I'm in my 26th year in the School of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It's a great job. I work with really fascinating people on intriguing problems, and it's a great place to be. All right, so you saw the title. I've been active in suborbital, commercial suborbital, since about 2009. If you go to slide 2, there's a photograph of myself in warmer weather in front of our beautiful Neil Armstrong Hall of Engineering and a statue of our alum, famous alum there as a when he was a student. And this is where I get to do the fun work. And this is a still out of a short video that Blue Origin put together with me. And you have the URL there for afterwards to go take a look at that. And this describes the payload that, well, in about 2 minutes, it describes very briefly and in a shallow way the payload I flew with Blue Origin back in June. And I got involved with them in 2009. A Purdue alum, John Gedmark, had helped found what's now the Commercial Spaceflight Federation. And John was pestering me throughout 2008 that I need to get involved with commercial suborbital, these new rocket companies. And I would brush him off and say things like, oh, the Federation, I'm sorry, I'm with the Galactic Alliance, John. I can't work with the Federation. Or I'd say, that's nice, I'll bring my dilithium crystals, ha-ha. And in 2008, in December, he finally got me out to the American Geophysical Union, which had a workshop in December of 2008 on next-gen suborbital. And I saw that people were, companies really were burning real propellant, cutting real metal, or composites, as the case may be. And there really was a lot going on. And so that's when I chose to get involved. And in 2009, several of us were selected by Blue Origin to be their Pathfinder researchers. Where we worked, we were given launches with Blue Origin, and they learned to work with researchers and what researchers wanted and needed and how to do this, because research flights were a big part of their business plan. And that, you know, even simple things came out of that. For example, when a rocket company writes about the input and the output, the I/O for a payload, that's exactly the opposite of what a researcher thinks I/O is. And all kinds of things we've worked through. So slide 3, there's a photograph there, and again, a URL at the bottom to go onto YouTube and watch a video of this flight at your leisure after the talk. So here's a photograph of two Purdue students. Actually, by that time in June, they were fully Purdue alums. They graduated in May. They were two of the students involved on the team that helped me finish up this payload and perform the flight. There you see the Blue Origin's booster after the flight. It landed just like that. This photograph was about an hour after landing, and after about another hour of Blue Origin's work, we actually were permitted to walk right up to the booster itself and take an up-close look at the booster post-flight. So that's out at the West Texas launch site that Blue Origin has. In case you're not aware, Blue Origin is funded by Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com fame, one of the 10 or 15 wealthiest Americans, maybe even higher than that now. And he owns a big chunk of the Sonoran Desert and has a ranch out there, and that's their launch site. Slide 4 shows us with their crew capsule. After its landing that very same day, the very same flight, capsule comes down under parachutes, you'll see in the video, and retro rockets at the very end. And a couple things I want to point out here. Our payload was inside there. And if you look at the lower right of the capsule, you see a little scrub brush there, still with green leaves on it. And if you look at the grass, little tufts of grass around the base of the capsule, it doesn't look like anybody fired any large rocket there. It really was a pretty gentle landing. And the other thing I want to point out is those gray, almost rectangles, rounded rectangles, painted on the side. The next capsule that starts flying in 2017 will have windows that size, and Blue advertises them as the largest windows in spaceflight history, and up to 6 passengers will fly in that capsule. So our flight in June was uninhabited. There were no people in it, just payloads. And there were 4 or 5 payloads, I forget exactly what, on the flight. We were one of them, and everything went smoothly. You'll see in the video when you go to watch, we were actually part of the flight test program. So they actually tested one parachute out for the landing of the crew capsule, and it was fine. We saw no damage to the experiment or not. So my experiment, I work in fluid dynamics, low gravity fluid dynamics, and which is liquids and vapors together. If it's all gas or all liquid, it's really not very interesting. So two-phase fluid mechanics in weightlessness is a big part of what I do. And suborbital gives us 3 to 4 minutes of test time, which is a lot longer than parabolic aircraft flight, which, as you know, is 20 or 25 seconds. You're also above a lot more of the atmosphere, so it's much, much smoother than any aircraft. And so it's another unique testing opportunity on the path from drop towers, which I've used as low as 0.8 seconds through parabolic flight, now suborbital, and then obviously orbital being the ultimate for a duration of the zero G. And yes, there have been NASA and ESA sounding rockets in the past and a few still operating. But I'm talking about the new commercial suborbital coming up in the country. So if you go on to slide 5, you'll see that I like to tease people that while zero-gravity fluid dynamics sounds really exotic, it's really an everyday event, because every day here we depend on satellites for everyday commerce, a lot of communications, not cell phones, but a lot of other communications, weather forecasting, crop production, emergency management, everyday defense. And each of these satellites consumes a liquid propellant to deliver on its mission or to maximize profit. And zero-gravity fluid dynamics is one of the sciences behind these successes, these technological and business successes in everyday life. Okay, we have had commercial spaceflight for 50 years. It's communication satellites, and they're profitable. And so zero-G fluids is an everyday event, whether we're aware of it or not. Slide 6 gives an example photograph from the vane gap experiment in ISS that I was able to design the 2 vane gap containers for the capillary flow experiments that Mark Weisslogel at Portland State was principal investigator on. And those launched in 2006 and ran through 2007. Then a second generation went up later. I didn't design those, but my old PhD student did, so I felt pretty good about that too. And here you see this device here we're looking at really is about the size of a regular travel mug for coffee, okay, the interior size of it. And it's an elliptic cylinder, and there's a flat vein in the middle, and we get these 2 red fingers wicking up and the liquid on one side dropping down, and all this stuff is capillary-dominated fluid physics. It exists on Earth, but it's just overwhelmed by gravity. So rarely do you see anything. Rarely would you see anything like this on Earth, even though the physics still exists here on Earth. And this wetting of the liquid up these gaps, up the side of the vein, is what we call critical wetting. And this is really a phenomenon that we're either designing to use or to avoid in zero-G fluid systems. If we wish to keep liquid in one place, we try to avoid critical wetting. If we want to transport liquid, we create conditions that for which critical wetting will occur, and we can move liquid.
Hey, Stephen, this is Harley.
Yeah.
Playing the role of moderator. I think somebody has their microphone open. I wonder if everybody could check to make sure that you're on mute. Again, except for you, Stephen.
Right.
So thank you. I think somebody turned it off, so thank you. Please continue.
Okay. So this is an example of zero-G fluids. This, the results are applicable in space to propellant management device design in liquid propellant tanks, to water-air separators and water management in life support systems. It's applicable to something I flew recently in the airplane on separating blood and air passively in weightlessness. On Earth, it probably has some relevance in small-scale medical sensors and devices, lab-on-a-chip type flows, and water management in certain fuel cells. This is also relevant, too. Okay, well, there's other topics for suborbital. If you go to slide 7, and there's a lot of things. I start with mesosphere and lower thermosphere studies, the MLT. There's very little data from these parts of our atmosphere. They're often nicknamed the ignorosphere because of the absence of data. This is above all the balloons and below all the orbits, and there's still some air there, and there's still some carbon transport, and there's still some winds some days and winds not some other days. Noctiluminescent clouds are a big focus right now in there. So NASA and ESA sounding rockets have gone through these altitudes before, but they go through quickly and rarely. With commercial suborbital, we expect to have many, many more flights through this region, and so we expect this to be one of the big early markets for research flights. A friend talked about he got interested in this part of the atmosphere when he realized he knew more about that part of the atmosphere of Titan than we knew about Earth's mesosphere and lower thermosphere. Combustion physics. Certainly there's a long history of drop tower aircraft flights, space shuttle ISS experiments in combustion, and 3 minutes, you can do a lot in combustion. Human physiology, I'm not the expert to say what on that, but obviously there's a lot of things going on in our body and adapting to weightlessness and living in weightlessness. And 3 minutes of the transition to zero G is when a lot of things happen. There are, for cellular biology, I know there have already been 22nd long experiments on calcium signaling between cells that have been done in the Vomit Comet. So 3 minutes is a lot longer, and a lot more things become available for cellular biologists. Some astronomers want to get above even more of the water vapor in the atmosphere, for example, and others want to point telescopes at places you would never point a big expensive one. And close to the sun, for example. Particulate collisions, such as in Saturn's rings and planetesimals or agglomeration and weightlessness, some of those have already flown with Blue Origin. Chemical reaction dynamics, fire safety. Spaceflight medical procedures can be practiced and rehearsed and tested out in 3 minutes. Spaceflight technology readiness or TRL advancement, I think suborbital is key for that, and the NASA Flight Opportunities Program in STMD already has existed for several years, 3 or 4 years, 5 years, pursuing use of these vehicles. Sensor testing, Earth observation, filming and coding processes, physics of foams, educational payloads I put there, and corporate team building or rewards. This seems a little odd, that last one, maybe the last two. I initially put this talk together for a corporate R&D, nationwide corporate R&D conference that I was asked to speak at, and I started to take that flavor out, but I thought I'd leave it in for you folks, so you see as things go by that this really does this commercial suborbital really does open up spaceflight to more than what has been before, and I'll also give you a wonderful, I think it's a really fun example of an educational payload in this market that I don't know how else we would look at doing this. Slide 8 shows you that, wow, I've had a lot of people along the years helping me out on this, enabling different things from countless of our undergrad and grad students at Purdue and department support, Armadillo Aerospace, Blue Origin, Exos, X-Corps, Maston, NASA Flight Opportunities Program, the late NASA Reduced Gravity Student Flight Opportunities Program, which I think a lot of us felt was the best thing NASA had ever done in education. And many Purdue alums, young alums, donate now each year for student travel and to get us to launch opportunities and integration integration trips and that sort, and to help with networking for students getting jobs. This is a, you'll see why we have so many alums interested in this. So slide 9 answers the question, how did we get here? Like I said early on, I'm a professor here. I'm also associate head for engagement, which involves alumni relations and publicity and that sort. I've been doing teaching and research, freshman through PhD, since 91. I actually got started with zero-G fluids in propellant systems as a summer intern at Lockheed Missiles and Space in 1981. And Purdue 91 to date, including a sabbatical back at Lockheed Martin Commercial Space in 97, and then another one at Rolls-Royce here in Indianapolis, helping them on research planning. I consult for a number of companies on low-G fluids work and deliver professional service in many flavors. Slide 10 goes over some of that service. Those of you on the phone early heard Mark Schellhamer talk about SARG. That's the Suborbital Applications Researchers Group of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation. I'm presently chair of that. I took over chairmanship 4 years ago from Alan Stern. He was getting busy as New Horizon was approaching Pluto. This is a group of about a dozen early adopters of these research flights, and we also provide advocacy in Washington, D.C. I know Ken Davidian had heard from us in his previous position in FAA there, and we also talked to NASA headquarters and the House and Senate staffers and occasionally some OMB or other people there, too, pushing this use of these vehicles for science and education. I also serve on the Science and Technology Advisory Board for CASIS. I just began on the Committee on Biological and Physical Sciences and Space for the National Academies, and I am on the board of ASGSR. I have even invited testimony, you see on slide 11, to me on the right, the big name on the left there, Wayne Hale. So this was in May of 2003, and speaking on the use of suborbital for education and research. So if we go on to slide 12, then, I wanted to talk about, besides Blue Origin, which I started with, and they're clearly the current leader in the business, as they've flown that vehicle 5 times in about 12 or 14 months, all the flights successful, including a spectacular flight in early November with the capsule escape rocket firing at max dynamic pressure during ascent and everything landing beautifully. Those, that booster and capsule are retired, and there'll be new ones coming online here in 2017 for our flights. So there's some other companies out there wishing to be your provider. Slide 13, of course, shows very picturesque Virgin Galactic, their previous vehicle in flight. Slide 14 shows February 2016, its replacement. Virgin Spaceship Unity rolled out at Mojave Air and Spaceport. That is me in front of it there. Slide 15 then also says that the design appears to be largely the same, but apparently has a number of improvements. They are talking a little more about that, about what they changed and updated. But it's largely the same exterior curves. Their flight test program, they are in flight test now, and including they just did a gliding flight, dropped from the mothership. So flight test has resumed, and they're heading back towards getting operational. You may know that around Halloween of 2014, they had a tragic accident and lost one of the pilots and the spaceship. So this will have a pilot, co-pilot, and 6 spaceflight participants. They've sold close to 1,000 tickets, I believe, already. Or the part that interests many of us would be pilot, co-pilot, and 1 to 6 researchers with science payloads, technology payloads, product development, or educational payloads. And this will be a very interesting capability as that comes online. Slide 16, now we go to Masten Space Systems. We see a white bullet hovering there over the desert. They're also at Mojave. They've developed a successful business flying left and right rather than up and down. And by that, I mean they've built lunar lander style of rockets, and there's a lot of work on inter-descent and landing, algorithms, controls, sensors, integration, all these things that people have found that their vehicles are wonderful test beds for. So Masten has been doing a lot of flights left and right, and they still intend to go up and down someday. And we have a payload sitting on the shelf waiting for them to go up and down. So they've been flying a lot. They've been flying frequently. And how frequently? Well, what's frequent for a rocket? I said Blue Origin flew that 5 times in 12 to 14 months. And many of you know better than I do how often Shuttle flew. Go to slide 17. This is their 10-day average flight rate. This is their data. And you can see that there are times when the average number of flights in 10 days is 100, more than 100. The four colors there are four different rockets, four different vehicles they've had. The gold one, 0A, was an early one and is being retired. And you see the green one, Zodiac, has been ramping up. So they fly 10 times a day. 5 times a day, many days. The average, overall average over that is about 5 times a day. So that's very, very frequent rocket flight for the last 5 years. This is, I think, very underappreciated, very underpublicized. So slide 18 shows, I wish I had their video for this, but these are 5 stills, 5 hover flights in 1 day of the same vehicle, and you see they're roughly 15 to 30 minutes apart. Very rapid turnaround for these flights. Now, these are low-altitude test flights, and you see them hanging on a tether. The tether is a common method a number of the companies use with lunar lander-type vehicles so that when you make changes in control systems, you make changes in actuators, you make all kinds of changes, you don't risk losing your rocket the first couple times you test those out. If something goes wrong, you shut off the rocket, and it just hangs on the boom. So that's a very cost-effective way to tolerate failures in early flight test. So Masten has been flying a lot. We go on to slide 19. We see Exos, which I note was Armadillo, and no people on board. It's a fully reusable tube rocket. Ethanol and liquid oxygen. It's really nice to have green, non-toxic propellants. About a 20-inch diameter, a little over that. It's a gentle 4G boost, no spin, which for my fluids experiments, we very much want to avoid spin stabilization on ascent, because even when you de-spin the rocket, the liquid in the reservoirs will still be spinning. So I love that this has no spin. I think a very powerful feature of this is their GPS-guided parafoil returns the payload section right back to the launch area. I've watched this on several flights. If you think about the control truck being about, I don't know, half mile from the launch pad, and the parafoil brings the payload back right to the midpoint on the line between those two. It's really ideal for research. You have very quick access to your payload. After landing, there's a number of biology experiments that very much want that. And so we flew 6 or 7 times with Armadillo. They ran out of money from their sugar daddy. And then it took them a little while to arrange new financing, and they've done that. And now they call themselves Exos Aerospace. They told me, of course, we changed the name, and Armadillo can't cross the road. Why would we name an aerospace company after that? But they are headquartered east of Dallas in a very small town out in the desert, and then launched typically at New Mexico Spaceport America. And they are heading back into flight test in 2017. I've got a payload to fly on their test there. What have they done? If you go to slide 20, you'll see a photograph from one of their flights in 2012. commercial suborbital spaceflight is very real. This was in flight test for them, so it wasn't actually a commercial flight. I had a payload on this flight. That big orange thing is a balut, a Ram Air balut that is only inflated up there because of the helium that pushed it out of the tube. Some of that got caught up in it and inflated it neatly. So this is, they hit 93 kilometer altitude. And I want you to note the tether attached to that balut is slack. If there were much air up there at all, anything as big as that and fluffy as that balut would pull that tether tight. So that's a very good indication of really how little aerodynamic drag remains up at that altitude, why I'm telling you these things are so much smoother than parabolic aircraft flight. This flight we did not get data from because the parachute broke off the rocket and impacted in the desert. So we never did have a complete start-to-finish successful test flight with Armadillo, but we're looking forward to EXOS. If you go on the next page, slide 21, you'll see X-Core. Building a fully reusable winged rocket plane, liquid fueled with a pilot and a spaceflight participant, so a lot smaller than Virgin Galactic. Virgin Galactic will be like the minivan to space. This will be like, you know, the two-seater sports car to space. But back in May this year, they had layoffs, and vehicle work was paused, for lack of a better word. And the X-Core is still in business and working on items which already generate revenue. I'm not sure what's going to come of the vehicle. It's a great idea that built upon their years of experience adding rocket motors to light aircraft and flying them around. So none of us really know what's next. We really hope this will fly. This could operate from many runways around the world, and time will tell. So flight test 22, people often complain about why are they taking so long, and I like to point out that flight test is really, like I say, by design, a most deliberate process. It's designed to uncover surprises, and surprises mean schedule delays. And if you enjoy safe aircraft flights around the country, you'd be a hypocrite to complain about the pace of commercial rocket flight test. Be patient. Flight test is slow. Then you think through things and you discover what's going on and what is and isn't working, and that's just the way flight test is. 23, I have a pretty picture from the facility from EXOS. I note they do work long hours. There we are at sunset in the Texas desert. Slide, and you can see the truck with a small rocket hanging on a tether on the left there. Slide 24. My Purdue teams worked the long hours with them. That's sunset, obviously looking east at New Mexico Spaceport America. East over that ridge you see on the horizon is White Sands Missile Range. Slide 25, let me tell you about my teams. 20 years ago, two undergrads got me to be their faculty advisor when NASA started the Reduced Gravity Student Flight Opportunities Program. I actually sent them away the first time. They came back and pestered me. And, you know, I said, look, I'm trying to get tenure. I can't afford to be involved in another teaching effort. But it was too attractive from the zero gravity fluids point of view. I got involved, and it's been great for my networking. It's been great for building up experience. And it is start to finish. It was a tremendous educational opportunity of a team-based, multidisciplinary, original work, no answers in the back of the book, you got to deliver type of engineering education. And we really miss having it around. NASA Johnson Education has started up the NASA Next program, where they student teams compete and then design, build, and test various EVA tools in the neutral buoyancy lab. And so it's still a very challenging and exciting opportunity for the students. So in 20 years, we've had 50 parabolic flight experiment payloads, one student space station experiment started, somebody in education changed direction in the middle of it, and we got canceled along with a bunch of others, and it sounds like there's probably not astronaut time now for physical sciences, so we probably wouldn't have gotten up there anyway. We have one up for stratosphere glider payload we're working on a company with, and we've had 9 suborbital launches and currently working on 12 suborbital or parabolic flight payloads. And how do I do all this with students? Well, you've got to make it into a class so it becomes part of your teaching duties. I have a class AAE-418 Zero Gravity Flight Experiments. So three heads over that 20 years, 3 department heads and 3 deans have supported this class. I'm very fortunate for that and very grateful for that. And lab class budgets, that exist on campus for laboratory class improvement are generally used to support experiment hardware. Those come and go. Sometimes it's a corporate gift or personal gift money. There is no steady state. And then Blue Origin, Armadillo, now Exos, and Maston have given us payload space. Exos has 2. And these days now, I also compete for and win the Flight Opportunity Program grants for advancing spaceflight technology and readiness levels. Some of that's independent work. Some of that's collaborating with a company now and then. And that's going very well. And again, numerous young alums donate for travel. Some years the Indiana Space Grant Consortium partners with us. Like most Space Grant Consortia, they get requests for way more money than they have every year. And some years their budgets and calendars line up. Some days they don't. We've had a couple years, we've had some nice corporate donations, be it Northrop Grumman or Lockheed Martin or Aerojet. And those really help open up my time to focus on the science and the teaching with our students. Slide 27 then shows Brian O'Neill and I out at the Blue Origin West Texas launch site. That's in what Blue calls their customer payload facility. I think the rest of us would call it a double wide trailer. That's our experiment in front of Brian and the kind of large box in back of it, right in front of me. Is what's called a double height payload box for Blue Origin. That's one of their standard sizes. The single height you can see if you look under my arm and chest, there's one on the table behind me. The single height is roughly the size of a shuttle mid-deck locker, and the double height is exactly that. It's twice as high. I was not paying for this, so I went ahead and picked the taller box. I probably could have made everything fit the smaller box if I had to for budgetary reasons, but as a guest, I just took the big box. And when you write proposals or looking at testing, Blue Origin will send you a quote on what it will cost to fly your payload. Presently, these are all automated payloads they're flying. They've not started flying people yet. And I think it's safe to say that you would get a quote probably under $50,000 to fly the single height payload locker, depending on what's in it. Cost goes up when there's more safety work that needs to be done. If you said, well, I want to fly 3 liters of liquid oxygen, then yeah, the work cost will go up because there's more and more work to be done to assure that everything can be done safely. But compare that to the cost of a NASA or ESA sounding rocket, which really is not, there is no list price to look at. When I talk to researchers who have flown on them, we both in Europe and here in the U.S., those researchers tell me they've added things up, and it looks to them to be about a $2 to $2.5 million effort to launch on one of those vehicles. And so $50,000 versus $2 million is a huge difference, and that's why I see these new vehicles being so remarkably enabling for science and education. Slide 28 shows the logo for Xpreme. It's one of our payloads. Slide 29 tells you that that's the X-Corps Purdue Research and Educational Meteorological Experiment. I like to give people a handle to use to talk about these different payloads. So we have Xpreme. The joke here is Diana Ross had the Supremes, but I have the Xpremes. That's one better. So this X-Corps gave us some flights for a very small payload. If we could measure things in mesosphere and lower thermosphere that they would then use for advertising to show atmospheric researchers that indeed these parts of the atmosphere are available are accessible now. So let's see, the second, third. Right, so this is a very small one. Let's look at it on slide 30, those other bullet points I've talked about already. Oops, let me get there. Sorry, I hit the wrong button on my machine. There we go, slide 30. This is a photograph on the right. That's basically a 2U CubeSat-sized payload. It samples pressure and temperatures at and near the body. And that's really very simple data, but it can be had many different hours during different seasons, morning, noon, and night in different parts of the world. And that's what makes it unique. And again, it's also its main purpose is advertising to those people who are the actual atmospheric researchers and want different things and are going to round up more money than what I had available to build this. So this payload is ready to fly now, and we're waiting on X-Core to see if they're going to finish building there. So this what you see there in the picture is all student built. Obviously, students got carried away with the water jet saw, programming those Purdue P's into it. But we're off and running, just waiting for X-Core there. Slide 31. We are involved with a medical research company to look at some issues in medical care for future space exploration missions. Orbital Medicine Incorporated is a company, and treating a collapsed lung, I'm told, is one of the goals for future spaceflight with NASA, and that requires chest suction and drainage, and that's very simple to do in 1G. In 0G, the piston pump still works great. But separating the blood and the air after it comes out of a tube is difficult in zero G. And you want the blood to return to the astronaut. There's not a large blood bank down the hall. And every astronaut wants the air separated to breathe the air. So both of these are very scarce, limited resources in long-term spaceflight. So we've been working with them to create a passive device that, using capillary effects, will separate the blood from the air as the suction is going on for treatment. Patient aspiration in reduced gravity is what it's called. And on slide 32, you see we are scheduled for the first Blue Origin launch of 2017. This launch was acquired by Orbital Medicine with a Flight Opportunities Grant from NASA. First, we tested the hardware last month in parabolic flight testing. 25 seconds of fairly bouncy, 0G at a time, and bouncy there is just because it's in the atmosphere. 0G flew well, the payload worked well, and we're tweaking just a couple little things to get ready for the suborbital flight, and primarily improving camera angles and visualization of the flows. So my undergrads have built this and tested it. They flew with it. Made it happen in the aircraft, and we're marching ahead for flight in 2017. Slide 33 shows part of this blood air separator outer shell being machined out. Back when I gave this talk the first time, that was the latest, greatest. Now that device has flown very successfully in zero G and parabolic flight. Slide 34 is a bright color for mission patch. Across the top, it says Zero Gravity Glow Experiment. And you see this is West Lafayette Community Schools, a second grade class here in town. Purdue's in West Lafayette, in case you weren't aware. Their teacher was at a government lesson. They were very interactive, a long-term government lesson. Each year they're moving further along the path to get the Say's Firefly declared the state insect of Indiana. And as part of that, one of them asked if fireflies would light up in space stations. So the teacher emailed the question to me. And it came at a great time because I was able to email back that I don't want to guess an answer for your students. Let's build an experiment. And we are doing just that because these days, if you go on to slide 35, ZGI, they call it, Zero Gravity Glow Experiment, and then there's this Arete STEM project now that's listed in the third bullet point. that has started up to enable K-12 spaceflight. And for $5,300, we can launch, anybody can launch their school's 2U-sized payload in suborbital space. I'm fundraising donations. I want to show that, I want to show the nation that communities can pitch in and fund spaceflight for their students, because $5,300 is about a third the cost of football uniforms, okay? Schools all over the country buy football uniforms because parents and local businesses contribute and decide it's worth doing. And I just want to show folks that when we decide K-12 spaceflight is worth doing, that's even easier than football uniforms. Now, I'm also teasing Blue Origin that they do need to get the price down to, like, basketball uniforms. But in the meantime, $5,300 is a pretty low cost to get a payload into space. And Ziggy is now assigned to Blue's first launch in 2017, along with the blood-air separator for orbital medicines. All of two payloads on the Blue Origin flight. Slide 36 shows a little early demo prototype of it we were using with the second grade class. Starting in the back, there's a on the ceiling, you can see a small video camera. There's a linear actuator on the bottom right that pushes a syringe and mixes the relevant chemicals. So we won't fly actual fireflies. I don't know how to train them, and the idea of shipping insects around the country seemed silly. But firefly chemistry is well understood. The actual luciferase molecule is used as a detector in biological experiments, a fluorescent detector for the ATP molecule, which is the power source our cells run off of, and actually is also how fireflies power that glow chemistry. So in this syringe, in the cut-up syringe in the foreground, that's where the mixing occurs, and the camera will be videotaping the glow for the students. So all this happens in a, you can see the AA battery standing next to it. This is a pretty small payload, and it will actually, it's all in an opaque aluminum case. We're not flying the transparent box, but that's like I said, this is for the classroom demonstration. So things are going well there. We are under the weight budget. We are under the power budget. We have we can make use of the power supplied from the Blue Origin system, which is actually being run by NanoRacks, 9/10 of an amp at 5 volts, and that's 4.5 watts. So that's more than enough, even with both the actuator and the camera running. So we're in good shape, and we look forward to doing this. And I'm still fundraising, and we're getting there. Slide 37, to start summarizing, what have we learned? We've reminded ourselves of several things over 20 years. Aerospace students love spaceflight activities, and design, build, test is a powerful educational tool. DBT, design, build, test provides innovation opportunities. Students learn to innovate. And DBT, you know, sometimes it goes by, in my 26 years of teaching, it's been called 4 or 5 different things, from experiential education to student-directed projects to design, build, test to real-world, you know, it's just, the educational lingo keeps changing, but the value remains unaltered. And we find employers love the students who have these experiences. The photograph there is at New Mexico Spaceport America. That was Armadillo flight. That was the first FAA-licensed commercial suborbital flight. All right, slide 38, more lessons. Our students can really deliver on NASA Spaceflight Technology Advancement programs. That's not a student program we're competing in and getting grants. That's the full-up NASA Flight Opportunities Program, and our students are doing great. Our alums are donating to support the travel. In fact, we had parents of alums donate, and our fundraisers tell me that, not to be surprised, that some parents are so relieved that their child actually graduated, that if they think you had something to do with saving them a year's tuition, they're happy to send $500. So this class is also a great recruiting tool. We have a really big, large, colorful poster up on the wall here where the high school students can see it when they come through with their parents. And no other university is so deeply involved in suborbital and zero-G parabolic flight testing. I know Embry-Riddle in Florida does some. Professor John Kuhlman at West Virginia does some. Professor Ricard Gonzalez at the Polytechnic University of Catalonia in Barcelona, Spain, does some with the ESA programs. But Purdue here, we've, my, like I said, 20 years of heads and deans have really enabled us to charge ahead and be leaders in this. And K through 12 spaceflight is now cheaper than high school football uniforms. That's a good message there. On the left, that's one of our small payloads with Armadillo. On the right, that was this June. I was even able to take a couple of incoming freshmen on the mission with me on the parabolic flight. Slide 39. We've had some real high-achieving alums come from this program. A couple young engineer awards from the Alumni Association, Navy test pilot, Navy lead instructor pilot in Hawkeyes. There's a 31-year-old aerospace VP in the world that went through this class, senior director for Falcon 9, MacGregor test facility leader, senior VP and chief strategy officer, and a credit monitoring company, and more. Now, obviously, I don't take all the credit for that, but I certainly didn't do them any harm. Going on to slide 40, this is where the industrial flavor comes back in. These slides I put together for R&D leaders in industry, very diverse industries around the U.S., and right now, the early adopters are flying, okay? The earliest early adopters. It's not too late to be an early adopter. You can be one, too. And by this time next year, you'll be behind the curve. Blue Origin will have numerous commercial flights behind them. Exos will be up and running. Virgin Galactic will be nearly through flight test, and it's really going to pick up. If we go to slide 41, what's next for you? Well, the Suborbital Applications Researchers Group, get in touch with any of us, partner with one of us, or we can point you to other people, too. K-12 experiments will become common. Get your kids or your community's school. What better way to help preserve or increase the value of your house near a public school than to lead them in a spaceflight mission? It's fun, too. It's excellent for university education. Get your alma mater involved. And this is where the cost can come down to, R&D employee team reward or motivational tool within a company. Already we hear of companies trying to use other spaceflight things for this purpose, and this becomes a wide open space for thinking also about improving your products, processes, etc., when they involve liquid coating or foam or, electrostatics or all kinds of other processes. People really need to, I was trying to encourage people to think innovatively. When I talk to a lot of companies, they say, we don't do anything in space. So, yeah, you have not done anything in space because it's been hard to get there. That's changed. It's becoming very simple to get there. Now that you can go to space quickly and cheaply, what would you do to advance your product line? So one place also I'd like to urge you to look, this final bullet here, Next Gen Suborbital Researchers Conference, June 1st to 3rd, 2017. This is run by Commercial Spaceflight Federation, and the SARGE group I chair manages the technical content, and all the flyers, all the flight providers will be there. NASA will be there, FAA will be there, spaceports will be there, other researchers will be there from a wide variety of fields, and it's just really an exciting place. There's a URL for it you can go to afterwards, and slide 42 shows you what you're going to see there. That's and then there, obviously the enter here at the bottom when you go to the website, not this slide, will take you there. Slide 43, I want to conclude that folks need to start thinking more innovatively. What parts of product development are stalled by questions which could be answered in zero-G? Within aerospace, this is also very much what is stalled in TRL advancement that, you can take it from 4 to 6 in a suborbital flight that would enable further advancement in spaceflight. Spaceflight experimentation is no longer a slow, expensive, single-shot government thing. is now a commercial thing, a free market. It's an affordable thing. It's a repeatable thing. At 50 grand a flight, you can repeat experiments. It's a rapid thing and even a K through 12 thing. So it's very, very different than what we've seen before. So if we go to the final slide, 44, I would say that, again, the earliest early adopters showed up in 2009. Don't miss out on the next stage of growth. And right now is the beginning of commercial operations, so don't hesitate. Start looking at this. NASA Flight Opportunities Program for TRL advancement should have another call out like in March, roughly. Look for that. And what companies will change their market space with new innovations from new thinking that's delivered in suborbit? So presently, few people are thinking of suborbit as a tool. So if you do that now, you're going to be a leader. Otherwise, you can be left behind. So that concludes what I've prepared. And you folks have been quiet. And I'm very happy to answer questions.
Great. Stephen, this is Harley. Thank you so much. This is a terrific presentation. I agree. It seems like for the right company, and a forward-looking company, a great opportunity. Have a question. Let's see. I was looking back on the team photo on page 37, slide 37. And, of course, I don't know there who are the engineers, the managers, the faculty members, the students, and so on. I note, and so here's a question, how you may have handled the challenge. Can't be sure, but it looks like there are two young women there and a bunch of men of a bunch of different ages. How successful have you been in engaging young women into getting into this field?
Oh, I don't know. The two young women there on the right in the black shirt, Olympia, Dr. Spiropoulos, and then I forget the young lady in the green shirt. They're both, they were with the German payload that was on that experiment with us, on that flight with us. Only about four people in there are Purdue people. You know, we have, in my department, we have about 15% women as undergrads, and they come through my class, just like my lecture classes, and they contribute and in various ways, just like the men do. So I would say it's I don't treat them any differently. I don't say, oh, well, women like to do this type of task, not that type of task, so I'll put you over here. Some of them are in the machine shop. Some of them are doing CAM work. Some of them are doing K through 12 outreach that we do. So there's a variety. I would say, you know, here at Purdue, we have a lot of impressive students, and I see impressive work out of a lot of them. So I have spoken to various, more direct answers. These type of photos and the videos from these flights, we try to use as much as possible in recruiting of students. And certainly there's any number of targeted programs that target various groups, be it women or underrepresented minorities or financially disadvantaged or whomever, groups of high school and junior high students. So that's probably where we get the most use of it in terms of impacting women, as in targeted recruiting.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you. Do other folks have questions for Stephen?
Yeah, Stephen, this is Dan Luster. This is really just marvelous. I mean, it's great hearing about this. And, you know, many of your students have moved on in the aerospace careers. And I know you said a little about this, but I maybe you can elaborate. How does their experience with you influence their career track? That is, you talk to them later and you say, hey, how do you describe the value of what we gave you? You know, because that kind of thing would be really interesting if you want to give advice to others who want to design or inspire other programs. What's especially important to them looking back?
Yeah, thanks. And I'll answer that with the caveat that I'm not talking about something unique I did or I'm doing. I think anyone who puts together this type of class creates this type of opportunity where these benefits can be had. So I'm not bragging about myself here. I get wonderful emails 3 to 5 years out, which I don't get from any of the other classes I teach, unfortunately. And students talk about, alums talk about, you know, for example, going through when we have to do flight safety documentation. And they say, you know, this is so much like what I'm doing now with satellite propulsion systems. You know, you really got me thinking in a way of, or the experience got he or she thinking in a way of logic, of doing engineering in a logical process to answer certain requirements or to document, to show that you've met requirements. So I get emails about that. I get emails about, you know, it's just the alums appreciated the freedom to, you know, explore really where in this spectrum of talents that are needed in a program, the opportunity to explore where their own talents and blessings, you know, have the biggest impact. And so to find out that, you know, okay, maybe they're not, I have somebody exactly in mind when I say maybe they're not that good with partial differential equations, but by golly, they know how to work and they know how to get things done. I had one aerospace component company call and say, we're looking for a young engineer, a new hire who can talk to the machine shop. And I sent this one young alum there and put him in touch, and they interviewed him. And they called me up and they said, you know, his grades aren't that high. And I said, well, that's not what you asked for.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they hired him, and he's doing very well. He's been there about 8 years now. And last I saw his boss, they said in 10 years he'll be director of engineering here. So, you know, it's some of it's just providing another forum where various talents are valued, and you can give rise to that. Some of it is, for example, in these NASA programs, the external evaluation. They either get selected to fly by NASA or they don't. There's no way students can convince themselves that it's some crazy arbitrary criteria put together by this grumpy old professor. So that's very beneficial to me. Purdue's an amazing place. Dave Wolf retired from NASA more or less as director of EVA. He's a Purdue graduate, and the dean hired him part-time. He works now with my students in this class, the ones who are doing the EVA hardware for testing in the neutral buoyancy lab. Students are just thrilled to be working with a world expert in the field, and they learn so much from him about not just organizing and problem solving, but how NASA works. So there's just a wide variety of benefits that can come from this.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's really good.
I will add, we have one company that, you know, 15 years ago hired one of our students, and 5 years ago that student emailed and said, hey, we're hiring, get me some names. And we just have this has happened several times, 2 or 3 times in a row now with the company. We have a pipeline going from this class to a very good aerospace company, and that's been a big thrill.
I guess you said there were a couple of people around who were also doing this at their universities. You know, the case that you've made is that this is that putting experiments into space is easily accessible enough. You'd really like to think it would be done a lot more. What's the obstacle? What's holding people back? You'd like to believe this would be happening all over the place.
Well, you know, both in education and research payloads, there's a lot of people, I think, waiting until they feel these rockets are really real.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, until it's an operational industry. What I would like to get out the message out today to anyone on the phone or people listening afterwards in the days ahead is that we're really, by the time you write a proposal, get it funded, get a team together, it is going to be really real. Now's the time to stop waiting and get started. Another thing is, and this is where I'm probably going to irritate some people, you know, we've been spending millions and millions every year around the country, National Science Foundation and others, on researching engineering education for the last decade. And my take on this is anybody who's taught for 10 years has more good ideas than he or she has the time or money to act on. We don't need research on engineering education. We don't need to spend money researching engineering education. We should be spending that money doing engineering education. And so I think a refocusing of our national priorities would be appropriate. But there are plenty of people who tell me all kinds of reasons why I'm wrong. So who knows?
Professor Richard Fisher, I really enjoy your presentation here. And I like your analogy towards, you know, the football gear and so forth. And I it got me to thinking, it says, I believe you guys, Big Ten, and I'm down here in the South with the Southeastern Conference. Harley's over in the Atlantic Coast Conference and so forth. Why would we try to make, you know, is there something that could be done that would, get into university competition of some sort with the major conferences? Have you thought of that at all?
I have. And you know, it'd be similar to what NASA did with the Reduced Gravity Student Flight Opportunities Program. But the big difference is these are commercially available flight opportunities. Anybody can buy them. You don't need to, it's not government access. You don't have to be approved for it. It's like renting a van. You know, it's, I don't think we need to put a structure in place that would limit who accesses these by declaring winners. I think we need a structure that somehow encourages, gets the word out in this, that everybody can do this. And that's where this Arete STEM Foundation, Arete STEM Project, and its associated foundation is trying to do this for K-12 by rounding up major donations that will reduce the cost even further and by providing leadership. And that's organized by Steve Heck, who's a retired fifth grade teacher north of Cincinnati. But before he was a fifth grade teacher, he was an Air Force command pilot. And so he's really a very, very capable leader and organizer. And he's doing good work in the K-12 end. And for universities, I don't know. If NSF took a big chunk of their educational research funding and put it into doing engineering education, that would enable hundreds of schools every year to do this. Or maybe it's time for NASA Education to take a look at putting money this way.
Well, I mean, there's so much money behind, university sports, and they have a life of their own. And
right.
Just trying to have a competition between the universities themselves might be enough to generate some level of funding that would
right.
And then everybody's going and I'll say, but what is it?
I see what you're saying, right? Like a solar car program. Everybody can participate. There's a theme, there's
right.
a goal. And the other thing I want to point out is those solar cars look like stock cars with the stickers all over the bottom sides.
Exactly.
This is commercial space flight. Your experiment can look like a stock car. Also, all of your donors can have stickers on it, and it's not NASA space flight anymore. So it's different in that way too. So I've looked at that. I've looked at starting that in terms of Indiana universities, starting it local, and then after a couple years going national. It takes money and time, and it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. I have some irons in the fire, but I don't want to talk about them because they may not. We'll see what comes of them.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you all, folks. Thanks for having. Does anybody have any? We've run past our time, but we own this line pretty much around the clock. Anybody have, however, for Stephen, a quick question and a comment for me? You all have, in fact, this would be embarrassing, Stephen, was your email address on your charts?
Ah, good question. I think it's on the title chart, title slide. Let me jump back there. No, it's not, but it's my last name at purdue.edu.
There you go, guys.
At purdue.edu, and then drop me a note.
Exactly. Steve has encouraged interested partners to get in touch with him, and he's just given you his email, plus he has a bunch of URLs on his presentation chart, so please take advantage of them.
Oh, yeah, go look at those movies. It'll make you see it's even more real than my words will make you think it's real.
Good. Very good. All right, folks. Thank you very much. Thank you, Stephen. Go ahead.
This is Rand Simberg. Just a quick comment, I guess. Maybe you could expand a little bit. I was at a meeting with Dave Barnhart from USC and Jordy Puiksari from Cal Poly a few weeks ago. And they point out the benefit of the students for doing it, because they're having their students build CubeSats and fly them. And they said one of the benefits, to industry is, when we go, we send our students out there, the industry people are shocked that they know what ITAR is.
it's less of a deal with suborbital. Certainly by the time the payload users guides are published by the companies, they've been cleared for export. So the interfacing information is all, public. I have had a payload or two involving with the spaceflight technology payloads. I have had one or two that involve, some export control topics, and so I do choose those student teams from everybody who enrolls in the class with a little bit of care so that everything goes fine there, and I put them in a separate room. So I steal room from my own research program, my labs, for teaching purposes. And so, yeah, it comes up now and then in suborbital. It's a lot less of a big deal than in satellites. What I love also, people have asked me for years, students have said at Purdue, you should lead our small sat program. And I said, I got my hands full doing things already, and why would I stop doing what I'm good at, start doing what I'm not good at? But we did just hire David Spencer from Georgia Tech. David, who was doing small sats at Georgia Tech, is now a Purdue professor and doing small sats here at Purdue. And so he might be someone you'll want to hear from, too. He's a tremendous addition to our department.
Great. Okay, folks. Again, thanks very much. Thanks very much, Stephen. Great questions. And you know how to reach Stephen. We will not have a FISA seminar next Wednesday in respect of wintertime holidays of a variety of kinds that will be happening over the next several days. So good wishes to you all. And talk to you all again in 2 weeks on the 4th of January. So take care, everybody. And again, thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, everybody. Goodbye.